We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both formerly with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, starting with the local and Mayor Murray.
Yes. Let me see. Let me get my notes here. Affordable I had the
housing.
Wrong notes in front of me.
You're not doing it all. We're,
housing.
You're pulling the curtain from behind how we do this. We do it all from memory. We're just that smart.
No, I do some of it from memory. But the first story up this week is Mayor Murray asked his affordable housing advisory panel, the one that he formed, to come up with quote-unquote specific proposals to build 50,000 new housing units in the next 10 years. Now, that sounds good if you're looking for a place to live that's affordable here in Seattle, until you dig into the numbers and you realize that only 20,000 of those units are supposed to be affordable for families making 80% of median income.
Yeah, and how they define affordable, you know, median 80% of median income still puts you in the $60,000-plus range for a family of four.
Yeah, and now the other 30,000 of that 50,000 number are going to be market rate apartments, as if developers need any incentive to build, quote-unquote, market rate apartments. But some of the city's own studies actually show that the need is going to be closer to about 90,000 new units of affordable housing in 10 years. Right now, people have argued, and the city's own statistics show, that the need for affordable housing units is about 50,000 to 60,000 right now. So I'm having trouble understanding why the mayor's asking his affordable housing advisory committee to look into building 30,000 market rate units plus 20,000 affordable units, which addresses just a small amount of need.
And the other piece of that is that Seattle's long-term neighborhood growth plan calls for a certain number of new units over the next 20 years. Those numbers have already been met. And they've been
exactly.
met almost entirely with market rate housing. And that in turn has jacked up the rates for what used to be affordable housing, or that housing has been torn down to make way for market rate housing.
Right. And the problem with the whole market rate concept, too, is that among the need for affordable housing, about half of those 60,000 units that are needed right now are people who make 30% of median income or less. And the metric, of course, as you can see from Mayor Murray's announcement, is people who make 80% of median income. And when that's your metric and you don't have any plans for or any incentives for building affordable housing for the very poor, then you're really not serving a large population. And that's one of the big reasons why Seattle has a growing homeless population.
Yeah, and you're serving a very small population, which is to say the developers who are getting wealthy. And, you know, to be fair, wealthy young professionals who are moving into the city. But, you know, you're doing that at the price of forcing a lot of other people out of the city, so that, you know, it's a certain type of density that's being promoted. You know, and the argument, this is for density, this is for climate change, et cetera. Well, what's happening here is a massive direction of taxpayer money into subsidizing commercial developers that don't need subsidies, number one. But you're basically building an ark for the wealthy to survive climate change, and nobody else really is welcome on that ark.
Yeah,
and that's what Seattle's turning into.
And it raises the question, too, of who's going to be doing all the service jobs that will supposedly provide services to those new professional people who are moving into Seattle. Who's going to staff the restaurants? Who's going to clean their apartments and houses? Who's going to provide the bus service for them? You know, when you don't have housing for those folks, then you start to have a problem with providing those kinds of services. So that's an issue as well.
Yeah, or you wind up housing them 20 or 30 miles outside the downtown core, in which case the whole rationale of preventing sprawl and having greater density is subverted anyway, because now you've got people moving into the city who aren't going to give up their $40,000 SUVs, but you've got people who are forced outside the city who have to buy cars at this point because there's no adequate public transit and they're living way away, far away from their new jobs.
All right. Moving on, sticking with Mayor Murray, is pushing for some comments on the transportation levy.
Yeah, you know, he just announced his $900 million transportation levy to replace the Bridging the Gap levy. It's more than double the amount of tax money that was in Bridging the Gap. But apparently, from looking at what's in the new levy, it seems that it's only going to be repaving a few more extra miles of roads than the Bridging the Gap levy did. And a lot of people have criticized Bridging the Gap for not resurfacing enough roads. So that's not very reassuring to me. But
so where's the rest of the money going?
It's going into things. Well, I mean, we talked about it last week. It's going into things like planting more trees, putting some more major arterials on road diets, extending sidewalks, you know, and some good things, too, that would be expanding transit. But the issue here is what's important. And you can expand transit all you want, but it's got nowhere to go if the roads are falling apart. So that said, I think it's interesting that the mayor is rushing the public comment process. In fact, the first of three meetings is happening today in Southeast Seattle at New Holly, which is 705 32nd Avenue South at 10 a.m. So, you know, if you have plans to go there and make a comment, you better get out of bed now and take a shower and get in your car because traffic's a mess this weekend.
Yeah, and don't rely on public transit because it doesn't go down there on the weekends.
Yeah, exactly. The second meeting is going to be Monday at Roosevelt High School at 15th and Northeast 66th at 6 p.m. And then the third meeting's just Tuesday in West Seattle at West Seattle High School, which is at 30th and California Avenue Southwest at 6 p.m. So here we've got the three public comment meetings happening over a weekend when traffic is going to be probably at its worst with westbound lanes of I-90 closed, with the Alaskan Way Viaduct closed, with problems with Sound Transit Link. I mean, you know, if you can get to one of these meetings, make sure you let the mayor know what you think about the traffic mess here
Seattle. And when public comment on these types of proposals is usually spread out over about 6 weeks, not being rushed into a week to 10 days after the proposal.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to the House Democrats, state House Democrats released the budget plan this week.
Yeah, they released their budget plan, and this is the House Democrats, not Republicans, mind you. They completely ignored Governor Inslee's call for a cap and trade program and a tax on carbon emissions, which I thought was kind of interesting. And they opted instead to fund increases in the budget to cover the McCleary decision on funding K-12 education with some other new taxes. They opted for a 5% capital gains tax versus the 7% that Governor Inslee had suggested. That would be a tax on sales of stocks, bonds, and assets over $25,000 for an individual or $50,000 for a couple in any 1 year. It would exempt most primary residences, retirement accounts, and things like timber sales and the sale of agricultural land. And they're hoping that it would raise about $570 million in 2016, which is when it would go into effect if their budget passes. It would also increase the B&O taxes for service businesses by 0.3% to raise about another $500 million. And it would end seven tax breaks. It would repeal sales tax on bottled water, which is controversial. And it would limit sales tax breaks for Oregon residents, which is probably not controversial if you live in Washington. It would end tax breaks for other groups like travel agents, tour operators, and resellers of prescription drugs. And it would repeal a tax break for oil refineries, which is probably a very good idea.
So you would have to pay more taxes if you ride the duck?
I don't know.
This is a good thing.
Yeah. And the new revenue, of course, would go into filling the big hole for K-12 education as ruled by the state Supreme Court in the McCleary decision. That would be about $1.4 billion going into that part of the budget. It would also, and I think this is a very good idea, add about $90 million to mental health services here in Washington State to provide some more beds for folks who need inpatient mental health care. And it would also provide raises to teachers and state workers who negotiated those raises in their union contracts. So those are contractually obligated raises. And of course, the teachers teachers' raises have been put off and put off by the state legislature for years, and so it's time. So, but the big problem with this budget is not so much can they pass it through the House or will it pass through the Senate, although those are big questions, but it dips into the rainy day fund. And that's going to require a supermajority vote by the House and the Senate in order to do that. And it's pretty clear they don't have the votes for that.
All right. Moving on to sticking with the budget plans, moving on to national and the Republican House budget plan.
Yeah, the Republican House passed their budget this week. And yes, it was as dismal as you would expect. It cuts $5.5 trillion from the federal budget over the next 10 years. It included language that orders House committees, didn't specify which, just I guess all House committees, to draft legislation to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Fortunately, budget bills are not binding, particularly when it comes to their policy prescriptions. Budget bills mainly exist in order to set the spending limits for different line items in the federal budget. And the policy prescriptions tend to just be a this is what we hope to get done in the next year sort of language. Now, what it does do that is could very well be binding is it turns Medicaid into block grants to the states, and it cuts it by about $900 billion. So poor people's health care would be literally shoved down onto the states as their responsibility, and it would be cut significantly. It also deeply cuts food stamps, which would also be turned into block grants and lose about hundreds of billions of dollars. It would also cut some other very vital programs like Pell Grants for low-income students to go to college. It would cut special education funding. It would cut job training programs and also low-income housing programs. And, of course, it includes the big whammy, which is a privatization of Medicare in the form of vouchers for the elderly to use to buy private insurance. Now, again, this is not a hard and fast or a direct change. It's a policy prescription, which means that it wouldn't necessarily happen, even if it gets passed in a Republican budget bill. So it is pretty dismal. It'll be interesting to see what the Senate comes up with, since the Democrats are able to exercise enough of a majority in the Senate to sometimes scuttle bills that only require a simple majority vote. We'll just have to see.
When they want to, when they're motivated.
When they're really motivated, yeah. Oh, and I should say, too, that the House budget bill increases military spending by $96 billion, money that is put into a special emergency war fund. And it happens to be more than double what the Pentagon actually asked for. They asked for $40 billion, but the House Republicans said, oh, you know, let's rob food stamps, let's rob Medicare, let's rob seniors and give that money to the Pentagon, even though they didn't ask for it.
I wonder what's up with that.
Because they want small government.
Yeah. And they don't care about poor people, the elderly. And
Sure they care about them. They want them eliminated.
Yes, they want them to go away.
All right. Also out this week, a second bill passing the House.
Yeah, and this one was a bipartisan bill. The Democrats joined the Republicans on it and voted for it. They added $140 billion to the deficit, which just proves that the Republicans are not really for balancing the budget when it comes to serving one of their major constituencies. This bill was to repeal cost controls on Medicare reimbursements to doctors. Now, since 2003, when a bill was passed to control the cost of reimbursements to doctors by increasing them only according to an increase in average prices in the economy, Congress has 17 times delayed putting that bill into effect, and each time it is voted to allow doctors to get fully reimbursed by Medicare. This time, this bill passed by both Republicans and Democrats in the House said that, well, we're just going to repeal that 2003 bill and we will never ask doctors to take a pay cut. We will always allow them to be paid whatever they think they are worth. And so you can see that Congress can unite on something. They can unite when it comes to serving rich people. In this case, doctors. Now, this is at the same time that the Republicans are continuing to make cuts to things like Medicare reimbursements to nursing homes or to hospitals. But when it comes to doctors, you can't touch them.
All right. Moving on, Indiana getting some coverage this week.
Yeah, a couple of different national stories coming out of the state of Indiana this week, and its conservative legislature and Governor Mike Pence, who has along with many Republican governors from the Midwest, national political aspirations as well. The first story that came out was an epidemic of injectable opiate use in a small county in southern Indiana, up in the hills, called Scott County, which is really a rural county, only about 10,000 people or so, and they'd had a number of deaths from whatever was going around. And so there was a proposal to allow needle exchanges the governor finally agreed to do, because even though he didn't believe in them, that's a key phrase there in Tea Party circles. the overwhelming scientific and professional evidence suggested that they would in fact save lives. And since the victims in this case were not inner city people of color, but rural white people who tend to vote Republican, Scott County now has a needle exchange. At the same time, Pence signed into law a bill passed by the Republican-controlled state legislature there, called a religious freedom bill, that would legalize discrimination against gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer people. And so in response to that, Salesforce, which people may be familiar with, it's a database company that has a pretty dominant share of the market for its software among both corporations and nonprofits. They're a big deal in the tech world. And their CEO, Mark Benioff, announced this week that they were pulling out of Indiana because of the passage of that bill, and urged a broader corporate boycott of the state as well in response to the passage of that that bill, which is certainly a clear reflection of corporate values than, say, let's talk about race. So there was that. And then also on the corporate responsibility front, BP became the latest and largest company this week to pull out of the of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They're only going to do it at the end of 2015. They join a number of other companies, including Microsoft and Amazon, that have pulled out of ALEC. But it does make you wonder if the problem with ALEC at this point is the agenda, or the problem is the negative attention that it's received. And there's some other replacement organization which is operating much more quietly toward the same ends with state legislatures to pass favorable agendas and favorable laws for corporations.
All right. And developments this week in Alabama?
Yeah. The United States Supreme Court had a major ruling this week. They decided 5-4 along ideological lines. And again, this was a narrow ruling in favor of something more progressive. So you had the four conservative members of the Supreme Court objecting to this. But it was a 5-4 decision ruling that Alabama had in fact done gerrymandering of its congressional districts in order to dilute the power of its black population there by concentrating black votes into one or two districts and making it virtually impossible to elect a more progressive candidates or candidates who represented people of color in the state's other congressional districts. It ruled that case should be sent back to the lower court because the lower court hadn't considered whether the racial impact affected just individual districts as opposed to the previous analysis that the lower court used, which was simply a statewide impact. But the real takeaway here is this is done under the Voting Rights Act, and the Voting Rights Act has since been discontinued because it was not extended by Congress last year. And so Alabama, like a number of other southern states, which have long track records of discrimination in their voting practices when it comes to people of color, is no longer subject to federal review in cases like this. So it's not clear whether, even if the Supreme Court and the lower courts find that the districts were gerrymandered and Alabama violated the law, it's not at all clear whether they have to do anything about it, or whether in this case discrimination is now A-OK. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
All right. Moving on to international news and Yemen.
Yes. The U.S. was forced to pull out all of its forces from Yemen. Yes, there were U.S. advisors and special operations troops in Yemen, primarily directing intelligence gathering and the drone strike program that was going on in Yemen. That doesn't mean that the drone strike program will end. It will continue.
Oh, it's still going on.
Yes, and it just will continue with much worse intelligence, meaning that it's far more likely that more civilians will be killed in the drones in the American-led drone strike program. In addition, the Houthi rebels have taken over most of the main cities in both northern and southern Yemen, and the former president of Yemen, I call him former now because he's clearly been deposed at this point.
Yeah, he's fled the country.
He was the U.S.-backed president. Now, the Houthi rebels are getting some support from the former president who was deposed from before, Saleh.
Follow the bouncing ball.
Yes. He is working in coalition. He and some of his supporters are working in coalition with the Houthis to take over the country, although it's not clear that they can control the country and be able to unite it. Yemen went through a long civil war for over a decade, and I believe it was the 80s through the 90s.
For a long time during the Cold War, there was North Yemen and South Yemen. There were two separate countries, and North Yemen was communist.
And they united, and then they went through a very long civil war.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, and also, kind of interesting in relation to this, Saudi Arabia shares a very long border with Yemen, and Saudi Arabia and a coalition of about 10 other Gulf states have,
and Egypt as well.
Yes, have gotten together and are now involved in the war in Yemen. Saudi Arabia started airstrikes against the Houthi rebels,
and the U.S. is providing support to those countries. And of course, the U.S. gives massive military aid to Saudi Arabia and to the Gulf states and to Egypt. So it's really the U.S. behind this. Using
it's now
those,
a regional war.
Yeah, it's a regional war with the U.S. Backing regional allies rather than intervening directly. And we've seen what kind of a can of worms this can open up, because the nearest precedent for that is across the Red Sea, and with Egypt and being used as a proxy by the United States when Somalia was controlled by Islamists that we didn't particularly like. And ever since then, for the last 15 years or so, Somalia has not had a functional government, and warlords have controlled various parts of the country. They're really, it's a libertarian paradise.
Well, and we're seeing the same thing in Libya as well. And that is also a regional war, because you have Yemen on one side, and I believe it's Qatar on the other, supporting Shiites versus Sunnis versus, you know, religious fanatics versus, you know, guys who just want to reestablish a military dictatorship. I mean, it really is an effing mess.
All right. Moving on to the crash in Switzerland?
Why don't we go to the Iraqi forces?
All right.
In Tikrit. Right.
Yeah, that's much more important. We kind of have a stake in that game, and
is getting less media attention as well.
Yeah, speaking of another war, regional war in the Middle East, the ongoing war that we started in Iraq is continuing. The main features of this war is the rise of a Islamic extremist group called ISIL, having taken over Mosul and much of northern Iraq. And of course, over the past month or so, the Iraqi army, assisted mostly by Shiite militias trained heavily by Iran, have been fighting in Tikrit to try to take over Tikrit from ISIL. The war for Tikrit had come to pretty much of a standstill. And so the U.S. said, well, why don't we get involved and send some airplanes up there and bomb? Well, there's a problem with that, in that the Shiite militias don't trust the United States for a very good reason. And they said, well, okay, you can bomb as long as you don't bomb anywhere near our guys. And what happened, of course, right off the bat, within 12 hours of the U.S. starting their bombing campaign, they dropped a bomb that killed six Shiite militiamen, and approximately one-third of the forces battling in to take back Tikrit withdrew from the battlefield. A number of Shiite militias said, "We're not fighting if the U.S. continues to bomb." And now where this really is a problem is you've got some 30,000 forces trying to take back Tikrit from an estimated, I don't know how many ISIL guys, maybe 1,000.
Yeah, it's a much smaller force.
It's a much smaller force, and they're not having any, they're not making any progress, and we just lost a third of them because the U.S. managed to drop a bomb in a friendly fire incident on some Shiite militiamen. And the big problem that could come in is if the main Shiite militia group decides to leave, that would be the Badr organization, then you'd lose the heart of the entire Iraqi force going against ISIL, because the Badr organization is basically leading the assault on Tikrit. So
and people with long memories may remember that in the early days of the occupation of Iraq 10 years ago, the Badr organization very much opposed that occupation and was personas non grata with the U.S.
They were considered kind of the moderate Shiite group, the biggest, the Shiite group with the largest amount of support in the country. And run by a moderate cleric, but nevertheless run by a cleric. And the United States saw that as saw them as people that we shouldn't negotiate with, and that we shouldn't allow to come to power because, of course, they have a religious leader. So on the other hand, now, because of course they have the most support within Iraq of any other civilian organization, and they were able to put together a very large number of militiamen, they now, and those militia, it turns out, were much more disciplined and much more able to take the training and adhere to the training of their Iranian advisors. They are now the most effective force in northern Iraq. And the guy who is leading them is the person who is really running the entire assault against Tikrit. So if they withdraw, that's really going to make the entire force, Iraqi force, fall apart. So we're kind of at a crisis point with that whole trying to take northern Iraq back from ISIL.
And it really underscores once again how poorly the U.S., even after all this time, understands the local forces and the different factions at play in that region.
Seems to be a theme we come back to Somewhat regularly on this show, over and over again.
Yes.
Let's stick our finger in where we don't understand what's happening and make it an even bigger mess.
All right. Events.
A couple of them coming up today that are worth checking out. One, the celebration of the upcoming first installation of the $15 an hour minimum wage increase. That will be at 1 o'clock this afternoon at Seattle Central College at Broadway and Pine on Capitol Hill. Seattle's getting a raise. And then at 7 o'clock tonight at Kane Hall, room 120, I believe, Physicians for a National Health Program, the Western Washington chapter, will be having their annual public meeting open to all free of charge. And you heard one of the speakers tonight on the 7:30 segment. That's well worth checking out. That's at Kane Hall on the University of Washington campus in Seattle.
All right. And then Monday at 2 o'clock is the city council hearing regarding the TPP.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yes.
So that should be exciting as well.
And earlier in the show, I talked about the public opinion meetings for the mayor's new transportation levy. Today, 10 a.m. at New Holly, if you can get down there. And then Monday at Roosevelt High School and West Seattle High School on Tuesday, both at 6 p.m.
And 10 o'clock today.
10 a.m. today.
All right.